The Evolve with Pete Evans podcast is a conversation about my favourite ingredients for a healthy human experience. We take an informed look at topics that include nutritional and emotional well-being, as well as expanded consciousness. I love exploring the topics that are not traditionally taught at school and take a deep dive into them with my special guests. I invite you to sit back and come along for the ride with an open mind and heart, and please share with your family and friends, as these podcasts may just be the seed from which many things will flourish from. Cheers. We've been using Waters Co. water filters for the last 10 years, and I wholeheartedly trust my family's health with them. Waters Co., established 1977, have personal and domestic water filters, which turns your ordinary tap water into great-tasting, alkaline, ionized mineral water, which removes up to 99.9% of fluoride, heavy metals, chemicals, and bacteria, so you can love your tap water again. The Bio 1000 is the latest edition of the BMP 1000 model and the culmination of over 40 years of experience and research into water filtration by some of the world's leading scientists. Waters Co. was first to market with natural gravity-fed systems, creating alkaline water way back in 1984, and have continued to lead the market in research and development, setting the benchmark for all other brands to follow. Please go to my webpage, PeteEvans.com, to learn more and to receive your special discount from my link on the products page. You're going to love it. Dr. David Martin knows who he is, and he's here to show others how to remember what it means to put humanity into the human experience. Over the past 5 decades, he's fully lived and has done so in service to humanity. Unlike many who build an identity around accomplishments, he uses his actions to show others the vast extremes of possibility. He's a speaker, author, business executive, and futurist, and Dr. Martin's work has been engaged in every country on Earth. He works with his family in every endeavor of life. Together with his wife, Kim, he directs the Breathing Enterprise workshops and facilitates implementation of integral accounting. Dr. Martin received his undergraduate BA from Goshen College, his Master's of Science from Ball State University, and his doctorate PhD from the University of Virginia. To find out more about David Martin, please visit his website, davidmartin.world. That's davidmartin.world. David, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast. How are you, brother?
It's lovely to be here, Pete. How are you?
Mate, really, really good. Funny morning, but here we are. And I really appreciate you sharing your time with us today and your wisdom.
Oh, it's a delight. And thank you for everything you're doing. It's great to have an open dialogue with some thoughtful conversations going at this time of crazy around the world. So this is really good.
It is crazy around the world. And I was watching your interview with Brian Rose last night, actually, and well done, mate.
And no, thank you. Thank you.
And the work that you did in Plandemic Indoctrination was just, it just gave it so much common sense, you know, if that's the right word that I could use.
Yeah. You know, it's funny, Pete. I'm amazed at how many people have had the unfortunate experience of kind of living in this world where they're spoon-fed a tagline, a headline, a media kind of meme, and just have no sense that the next thing you should do is go, I wonder if I'm being told something, or I wonder if I'm really being informed. And I think that the interesting thing about Plandemic was it was such a great experience of allowing people the opportunity, if they take the time to do it, to go ahead and ask the questions and have the ability to find the references for those questions that actually allow them to draw their own conclusions. I think Mickey and I were both committed to the kind of emancipation of free inquiry far more than we were interested in necessarily telling a story or having an agenda.
So how does it work? I mean, your brain, I'm fascinated by people all around the world. We've all got our own stories, but I'm always fascinated by people that think outside of the box and have an ability to see, I guess, the larger picture, and then to distill that into truth or facts. How does your brain work, and when did you realize that you had a special set of gifts or talents?
That's a tough question to answer in a short conversation, but let's take a stab at it. I think that the way I would respond to that question is slightly different in that I actually had to learn that other people didn't see things this way. The funny thing is I didn't know when I started because I didn't know that I was doing anything particularly interesting or unique. But I did find that very early as 5 and 6 years old, I was aware of things that I was mystified in why others weren't aware of them. The ability to perceive things, to sense things, to know things. Most interestingly, the ability to access information. Where a lot of people sit there going, man, how do you cram it all in your brain? And the answer is, I really don't. I have this, I don't know, what I would describe as an ability to tune into information. If I set my intention on a particular thing, I just have a way of finding it. It's less about what's in my head, and it's more about what I'm open to, I think. And I think that that's really an interesting paradigm shift for people.
When did you realize that you had a part to play in this world for good?
Yeah, I think, you know, I grew up in a very religious environment. And for listeners in Australia, you know, religion is an interesting thing because there's a bit more of a secular view of things, I think, in a lot of places. But in the US, particularly in the late 60s and early 70s, the counterculture movement gave rise to, on the other side, a bit of a very conservative and very dogmatic evangelical Christian response. And so you kind of had this really weird interplay between the social innovation, if you will, of the hippie movement, and then this very large kind of counterculture movement among evangelical Christianity. And I often have said that I was thrust into the middle of what was the equivalent of the Christian Taliban, the very conservative tradition of the Mennonite Church, which is a very unusual group, has some wonderful attributes, historically a peace-loving faith, a faith that's really concerned with serving humanity in a lot of ways, but it has a dark side. And the dark side is that it spends most of its time and effort being right. And that comes at the expense of everyone else being wrong. And so probably when I was about 11 to 12 years old, it became very clear that I was not going to be embraced by the tradition in which I found myself. And, you know, when you're 11 or 12 and you find out that you don't belong, then you get to go on a journey. And the journey is to build your lived experience of what life is going to be. And that means to take into account just wonderful perspectives of people of goodwill all over the world. I have had the great fortune of being in over 140 countries, lived in many of them, spent time, have friends in a lot of them. And that exposure to the plurality of perspectives allows you to walk away realizing that, once again, this is less about what you embody as your own necessary set of skills or talents. And it's more about what you're open to. Are you open to learn? Are you open to think differently? Are you open to experience the wisdom of others? And I think that as you open yourself up to that awareness, you find out that you're doing something very few people do. Most people want to fit in. They want to close themselves down. They want to make sure that they're not seen as an outsider. They want to make sure that they're not seen as strange. And I think strange has been part of my DNA for a very, very long time.
I think I resonate deeply with that too. I remember a friend of mine once said, it's okay to fit out. It's actually encouraged or invited to fit out. So we're not homogenized.
Isn't it interesting that, you know, one of the things I learned when I was living in Australia for a few years was the Australian trend is to have people who kind of find their way and potentially get very successful, and then they leave. And they go into the big world, whether it's Hollywood or they go into media or they go outside of Australia. And so it was very strange in my experience to go the other way. Here I am, you know, on Bloomberg and CNBC and all over the capital markets and all over the media in the United States. And then I rock up in Sydney and Melbourne and people go, kind of, what are you running from? there must be a reason why you're hiding in the convict colony, because, you know, nobody comes to us. We all run away from a place. And you're exactly right. There's a impulse that is so unconsidered, which says, how do we make ourselves conform, when people should just stop and realize that each one of us was endowed with amazing gifts and talents. We each have those unique sets of skills and talents that we bring to this world. And it is in the celebration of those things that we really achieve greatness. It's not in the conformity to whatever the status quo is.
Beautiful words, brother. You just mentioned one of your jobs, I guess, or one of the things that you've become well at is understanding, would currency be the right word? The driving force that seems to have us in this situation at the moment is the necessity and the greed nearly for earning and hoarding money and what that means. And I've never spoken about this on a podcast before. And the reason I'm bringing it up is because it seems to be this illusionary thing that can create madness
for people. Yeah. It's worth taking a little journey down memory lane, and we don't do this often enough, but if we go back to the 12th and 13th century, and that's where this starts, because the confusion between the concept of money and currency, and it's kind of poetic that you use the term currency and then you started talking about money, because it turns out that currency is actually the flow of an exchange of value among a community or among a society. That's what currency, thus the word current, right? It's the flow of things. Whereas money is actually an artifact, the artifact that you can accumulate or hoard. And those two things are very different. And it's important to realize that our current understanding of money is actually something that was derived largely out of the Crusades, and specifically out of the Templar tradition. Quite practically, if you think about the birth of the modern, what's called promissory note, which is just the technology, if you will, of money, there was a very practical reason to come up with this, because it turns out that if you have a big chest of gold in Jerusalem and you want to have some sort of consideration of value in France or in Britain or something like that, it's a heck of a lot easier to take a piece of paper that says you're entitled to a certain amount of gold. It's a lot easier to take that piece of paper than haul the chest, because if you haul the chest, you know, robbers can take it and bits can fall out of it and all sorts of other things. It's much easier to say, I've got a big chest of gold and I'm good for whatever I told you I'm good for. That's the whole birth of this concept of representational currency. Now, the cool thing is, when the Templars did it, one of the things that was very, very common for people to understand was the Templars were, in fact, good for it. If somebody said they were good for 5 pieces of gold, then somebody was able to produce 5 pieces of gold, and that was a pretty cool thing. The problem is, embedded within the very structure of money was the other and much more evil and insidious feature, which was secrecy. Because it's one thing to be able to say, I've got a piece of paper that says you're good for 5 gold coins, and then somebody produces 5 gold coins and you go, oh, that worked. But it gets more insidious when you start realizing that the technology and the society in which the innovation happened themselves got corrupted with this whole bit of secrecy. And so now all of a sudden, do you really have 5 or do you really have 10 or do you really have 50 or do you really have none? And the point is that the mystery that is derived of secrecy planted the seed that allowed corruption to come into the technology of money. You know, if we fast forward from the Templars, the first promissory note keepers, to the creation of the Federal Reserve in 1913, what we see is a straight line through that entire period of time where the veracity of what the paper said it was, you know, do you really have the redeeming note? That veracity was assumed by the public. But in the 1400s and in the 1500s, we know, for example, that the Duke of Sforza was very famous during the Italian Renaissance of counterfeiting the currencies of other regions of Italy and then going off and saying, well, if I undermine your faith and confidence in the promise, then I can undermine your faith and confidence in the leadership. So what we have now, Pete, is the ultimate consummation of the worst of what money is, which is a promise that can't be kept. And that promise that can't be kept is, in fact, the cover event for which COVID-19 is the probable cause. We're sitting here breaking promises left, right, and center about what our economies are, about what our currencies are, about what our finances are. We're breaking promises about the future of pensions. We're making promises about the future of entitlement programs. In Australia, we're breaking promises about what it means to have a social security system, a safety net for individuals, for healthcare and for wellness and everything else. We're breaking those promises, and we're doing it all under the cover of a cover story called the branded campaign of COVID-19. And it's amazing to see that this violation is a violation of integrity. It's a violation of the warp thread of the social fabric. But the corruption of this actually probably started around the time of Pope Innocent III in the 13th century. So we've been at this for a while.
So tell me about what is going on now. I mean, there are that many storylines. There are that many theories out there about this virus.
Yeah.
Whether it exists, whether it doesn't exist, whether it was man-made, whether it's a part of nature, whether, I mean, I asked somebody the other day, I said, how can all these governments be playing out this story?
Yeah.
It's nearly so overwhelming for my brain to, and even my heart and my soul to come to terms with, because there's that many holes in the story.
Yeah.
And when there's so many holes in the story, yet people are still believing it, that's a concern for me.
Yeah. You know,
part of me thinks, am I going crazy here? Because this virus, this disease, really doesn't affect too many people, yet it is affecting the planet.
Yes.
So still, what is going on?
Yeah, that's a wonderful question. It's answered in 1944. The Bretton Woods Conference, which was the establishment of kind of the World Bank system. The Bretton Woods system really established the U.S. dollar as the trade currency, as the selection of what would in fact denominate the global economy if, and there was a question mark, remember this is 1944, if the Allies won the war. Now, here's the interesting thing. If you go back in time, you have to realize that at that time, the dollar actually wasn't a mature currency. At the time, the British pound and the Deutsche Mark and the franc and other currencies were actually quite robust. But the concern was that with Europe being bombed into oblivion, that there was a high probability that the infrastructure to support the economy was going to be broken. And so choosing a currency like the US dollar made a lot of sense. Practically. But here's the tiny little secret that we don't like to talk about. When people ask the question, well, how could so many governments and how could so many people all kind of fall for the same thing? I remind people that this is what I would refer to as a controlled demolition. What happens is that when the world realizes, and you know, you're in Australia where something close to 80% of your economy is directly dependent on one country, where from the minerals and the energy that you send to the products and goods and services that you trade, the majority of Australia's economy is based on the Chinese trade. Now, nothing right or wrong necessarily about that, but there's a problem. Because when China says, I'm going to get off the US dollar, and they go around and sign all of the agreements for what's called the Belt and Road Deal. And then they start saying, well, hey, you know what? You don't have to use the dollar anymore. This controlled demolition, which we're living through right now, is an opportunistic use of the first part of your question. And the first part of your question is, okay, so what's up with the virus? Well, the answer is that varieties of coronavirus, not a coronavirus. And by the way, we need to be very precise on this. there is no novel coronavirus. We don't have a coronavirus. In fact, right now, COVID-19, as it's currently branded, has over 800 mutations of the virus that are the viruses associated with certain conditions. Bearing in mind that 95% of individuals who have a positive test for a virus have no symptoms. So there is no disease caused by a virus. There are mutations of viruses that have been associated with some, about 5% of people who actually develop symptoms. So as we look at that information, Pete, it's important for us to realize that we've been given a narrative that isn't even supported in the science. If you go onto the GISAID, which is the open source platform for the coronavirus research, you see that there are over 800 different strains of what's supposed to be a novel virus. Now, that means it's not a novel virus, it's a whole bunch of things. And the mistake we've made in this current iteration is to believe that somehow it showed up on December the 19th in Wuhan, China. Well, we know that's not true too, because in 2013, six miners in China developed all of the current symptoms of what's called COVID-19. And they were tested for a virus and they found a thing called the Wuhan Institute of Virology Coronavirus 1. Now, you and I haven't talked about that before, and most of the world hasn't talked about that, but that was written up in a master's student thesis in China. It has been published, and as early as 2015, the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill was making synthetic mutations of the Wuhan virus in Chapel Hill. So this whole concept that this suddenly just appeared in the population is ludicrous. We started testing it, that's true, but it didn't show up in December. We started testing it. And there's a big difference between that. When you haven't tested a thing, it doesn't mean it wasn't there. And by testing a thing doesn't mean you've created it. The fact of the matter is we have developed a narrative reinforced by a mandate to terrorize a population. And the mandate to terrorize a population is called COVID-19. The only problem with the narrative, and it's a big problem, is that almost everybody who thought they had the virus back in the early days, who got tested, almost all of them didn't have the virus. Over 90% didn't have the virus. They might have had something, but they didn't have COVID-19 and they didn't have coronavirus. 90%. And of the people who tested positive, 90% of them, more than 90% of them, had no symptoms, therefore no disease, which means we're measuring the wrong thing. There is something that's making people really sick. And I would go as far as, and I don't think I'm going to be a heretic in saying this to you, I think that we may be doing some of that disease to ourselves. I think through our diet, through our absence of exercise, through our absence of well-being, there's a decent probability that a lot of the symptoms that are presenting are symptoms that have nothing to do with viruses and everything to do with chemically modified foods and, you know, agrochemical, industrial modified foods and all kinds of other things. I think there's a lot that can explain what's wrong, but a virus isn't the story. A virus is the cover story.
So let's go back to the Belt and Road, because obviously we don't really talk about it. I've shared it before on my social media, just saying, can you join the dots yet? Can you see that New Zealand, Victoria, what they've signed into?
Yeah.
Explain that, and explain that the 80% of trade that goes to China.
Yeah. You know, it was interesting. After the Second World War, through largely the Allied campaign in the Pacific, Australia became the largest aircraft carrier that the U.S. ever had. The real value, and not surprisingly, if you look at the defense strategies from the Australian government, certainly since the 1960s forward, and my God, if you look at the craziness of the last 5 or 6 years of Australian administrations, where they're buying submarines that have no chance of standing up against Chinese military, land vehicles for the great land invasion that is going to come from where? the degree to which Australia has been this large aircraft carrier for the United States since the Second World War has been gradually undermined by the fact that the Australian government and the Australian companies have understood that they have to supply goods and services to their neighbor to the north. And it turns out that China, as a consumer of iron and the consumer of coal and the consumer of gas and other things that Australian companies produce, and corporate Australia has without question sworn their allegiance to China for a long time. That's where the checks are written, that's where the money flows, and that's where the loyalty flows. It's no surprise that when you fly into an airport in any part of any major city in Australia now, there are as many Chinese language signs as there are English language signs, and that's not by accident. The commercial expediency of that relationship is quite significant. But what happens inside the Belt Road relationship is really interesting, because several years ago, the most ironic deal was signed between most of the Southeast Asian countries, but it was led by China and India, saying that they were going to start conducting trade in the renminbi, not in dollars. So now you're in this very interesting problem where about the same time, the Chinese government also announced that it was officially marking down its U.S. Treasury holdings by as much as 30%. In other words, when we were pressuring as the United States, when we were pressuring China to get a more robust currency, they responded by doing something that was not in the U.S.'s calculus. They said, great, we're going to go off the U.S. dollar. We're going to devalue our treasury holdings officially. We're going to mark them down on our books. But what we are going to do is we're going to start conducting business with resource countries, Australia, most of Central and Southern Africa, all across the Asia Pacific region. We're going to start doing business, but we're going to do business where we're trading in currencies that are either renminbi, the Chinese currency, or the World Bank's very interesting use of what's called synthetic drawing rights. Now, I can assure you that you and most of your listeners may have heard that phrase, but you have never understood what that is. The World Bank started doing trades in synthetic drawing rights about 10 years ago, and nobody in the U.S. was paying attention. Nobody in Australia or New Zealand was paying attention. Nobody in most of Europe was paying attention. Eastern Europe was, but most of mainland Europe wasn't paying attention. But what a synthetic drawing right is it's actually a non-currency. It's an option to convert a value into whatever currency you choose down the road. And when the World Bank and when other countries started using synthetic drawing rights as part of contractual payments, the world changed and the world population was asleep at the switch. You know, you don't see the $3 billion GE bundle buy deal, and you don't see the big deals between Fortescue and BHP Billiton and those. You don't see those deals, but the number of them that are not denominated in currencies that you and I would recognize are pretty staggering. And that gives people the right to change the power structure underneath countries where the government that controls the currency becomes less and less relevant, because at the end of the day, this is as old as the Rothschilds at the Battle of Waterloo. The fact of the matter is, he who controls the gold of the realm controls the realm, and it's the companies that control the gold of the realm that are really the ones in control, and it's not the people who we think are the political and elected officials.
So let me ask you this question. When you see Donald Trump talking about the China virus, the invisible virus, is he talking about this?
So I think he is talking about the metaphor, and I think most people are not paying attention. When he sees this macro story play out, and I have long held that as much as it is politically expedient to kind of make jokes at what the president does say or how he says it or what have you, I've learned many times that you need to listen underneath language to get to the intent of what's going on. And there is no question that when he speaks of a China virus, there is a metaphor there, not a literal expression of this is the Wuhan Institute of Virology virus. That this is something where there has been a propagation of Chinese influence across an enormous number of economies that have been very explicitly involved since 1986. And this is a very important year because it was in 1986 that the U.S. Trade Administration, the U.S. Trade Associations, and the Office of Trade for the U.S. Commerce Department actually enabled the beginnings of what became the compulsory technology transfer between the U.S. and China. You know, we talk about intellectual property theft in this country all the time. But what we don't do is tell the truth. Because in the United States, there was an official policy in the 1980s during the Reagan administration that said it was so important that we get China's alliance with the U.S. stronger than their alliance with Russia, that through the process of technology transfer and corporate development, all these sorts of things, we were going to sell our future. And that means our innovation, our technology, our products. We were going to sell our future for the discount of making sure China did not rely on a relationship with Russia. China obliged. They sent graduate students to all of our universities. They sent graduate students to all of our labs. And now we are living in a world where at something over 10 to 1, China has more PhDs on any topic of relevance than any of the former allied countries have. They just have more people. So if they need to solve a problem, if they need to innovate, if they need to do something, they've just got literally more brains to put on a problem than anybody else does. And if we look at what's happening in the universities throughout Australia, we see that, not surprisingly, an enormous number of collaborations are taking place there. As a matter of fact, a number of the coronavirus patents are jointly held. Australia patents filed, jointly held by universities in Australia and universities around Beijing. People don't know that. Out of the 5,100 patents filed on coronavirus, the number that include joint filings that are officially registered to Chinese government agencies and universities and either US or Australian research facilities would blow your mind. And once again, these are commercial exploitations of coronavirus that have been well documented well before December of 2019, and all of us were asleep while all of this was being done.
So how does it work, say today in Australia? We have the different premiers across the states, Queensland, Sydney, Victoria, Dan Andrews in Victoria. We've got Prime Minister Scott Morrison. They've all got, they're chasing these clusters of outbreaks of this coronavirus. Do they actually know what they're doing? Far as what you're talking about, are they privy to the big picture, or are they just, explain how that works?
Well, having been in Victoria for 2 years, living in Melbourne, it became very clear to me that the government of Victoria was for sale to the highest bidder. There's no question that the notion that somehow or another there was this kind of patriotic sense of civic duty to the state of Victoria had long left the building. When you saw areas around Geelong and kind of the manufacturing belt where Holden used to be and all of the automotive companies around Melbourne, when you saw those kind of fall away in the period of time over the last kind of 5 years, and during that period of time, you saw Australian defense procurement trying to say, well, we're going to build a defense industry capability here. And then all of a sudden, South Australia goes, no, we're going to build it in our backyard. And then Queensland and the Gold Coast kind of go, no, we're going to build a sub-terminal in our backyard. And kind of everybody jumped on the bandwagon. Suddenly, Australia became this kind of defense manufacturing hub, which I found fascinating, given the fact that Australia has really never manufactured much of anything that is meaningful on the kind of NATO schedule of meaningful technologies. But somehow or another, Australia was going to suddenly jump into a world where Germans, French, and the US were going to dictate to Australia what its industrial policy was going to be. And I watched time and time again, you know, on either end of Collins Street in Melbourne, depending on which club you are, whether you're Liberal or Labor, the deals that were cut in there were if you award the right contract to the right person, then that elected official is going to become the CEO of Defense Company X Australia. And you saw this going on over and over and over and over again. So the Australia being kind of available to the highest bidder has been a longstanding tradition, but it gets problematic in this situation. Because in this situation, the script is actually being handed to people. Remember, and Pete, this is something that most people don't realize. People were declaring states of emergencies before the evidence for actually what they were declaring even existed. Victoria doesn't have an outbreak. They have positive test results, but they don't have a clinical outbreak. An outbreak is a clinical set of symptoms. That's a disease. A positive test is a potential testing error. It's a potential anomaly, but what they're calling an outbreak never has been an outbreak. It wasn't in New York when New York said that we were having outbreaks. It wasn't in Iowa when Iowa recently said we're having outbreaks. We're testing for a thing, which is a fragment of a thing that might be associated in a small number of people with a possible clinical condition. The fact that we are forcing people into taking tests means that statistically, and this is where Dan Andrews is so out to lunch. I mean, he needs to study elementary statistics because it turns out his criteria for reopening the state of Victoria is based on a statistical error rate, right? By simply taking the test, 5% of people are going to have a positive result because the test is in error. That's just the problem of testing. So a opening statistics lecture, right? If he went to Melbourne Uni or if he went to any of the schools, there are great schools in Victoria. If he went to any of them and sat down with a statistics professor and said, hey, if I say that we can't reopen until we're down to lower than 5 cases in Victoria, which is what he said, any statistics professor would say, dude, that's random error, right? On any test, 0.05, that's 5%, 0.05 is statistical error. Meaning Dan Andrews has said in public that his criteria for reopening Victoria is the error rate of the test. That's madness. That's not science. That's insanity. And what we have is a problem, which is a real problem, because that means he was handed a script. Somebody told him to say that, just like somebody told Governor Cuomo in New York to say that we needed 30,000 ventilators when at its peak, New York had 1,200 patients requiring ventilation. He didn't need 30,000 ventilators. Nobody needed 30,000 ventilators. There has not been in the world a moment in the world when the whole world needed 30,000 ventilators at the same time for this thing. Forget New York City. Which tells us that one of the things the public has to do is it has to get access to the internal communications because someone is writing this script. We actually know that the script was written by October of 2019. We know that the script was probably written by the Global Preparedness Monitoring Board in their publication in September of 2019. And we know that a number of the manufacturers of vaccines got word of something that was going to be an imminent, emergent, or deliberate release of SARS coronavirus by March 28, 2019. This is a script. This is theater. And someone wrote the script. My grandfather said, never attribute to malevolence what is ignorance, which is a really good piece of advice, right? Don't think somebody's bad just because they're doing something stupid. That's actually a really good piece of advice. But when public officials get in front of their populace and actually overtly harm the populace, instill terror in the populace, instill fear without checking any of the facts, that, Pete, is willful ignorance. And that's not excusable in any part of the world, under any circumstance, because the real harm that's being done, the real violation of humanity that's being done, is unspeakable terror. And all for something which is a script that was handed to elected officials, and they're reading from a script that they do not understand.
Explain that last bit for me, that they do not understand. So are you saying that they're not seeing the big picture?
Well, there's no question they're not seeing the big picture. Remember that it is not in anyone's interest. No governor, no premier. It's not in anyone's interest to melt down a domestic economy. You know, when New York or California or Victoria or Queensland or New South Wales actually damages an economy where 30 to 40% of the tax revenue, 30 to 40% of the small business, which is the engine that drives in every major developed country, 80 or 90% of the entire economy. When you wipe out 30 to 40% of that engine, that has to be a malicious act. Nobody does that in the name of public health. We have never, in the name of public health, even in actual moments of genuine outrage, of contagions, you know, back in the 2003 SARS outbreak in Asia, we have never, never harmed the infrastructure of the engine of an economy ever at this level. There is no question that when you shut down businesses, whether those be restaurants and cafes, whether those be small businesses, whether those be, you know, services, no matter what the thing is, when you shut those things down, you have no possible justification for doing so in the name of public health for a disease that 95% of the time is asymptomatic. That's not ever been done before. There's no precedent for it. And there's no justification for it. But the actual real cost, which is the tragedy in this, right? The people who have lost their jobs, the people who have lost their businesses, the people like me who actually loved running businesses for 30 years and employing people. People like me know how hard it is to find good talent. We also know how easy it is to lose people and how hard it is to turn things back on. The illusion that people are operating under is this notion that somehow or another you can kill off small businesses. And when we take off masks and we give everybody a vaccination, you can just turn the economy back on. Well, you can't do it because little companies take time to grow. And we have killed the incentive to build small businesses by letting them know that they may be exterminated at will in the future. Who's going to invest in small business going forward? Who's going to invest in a restaurant when you know that next winter or next spring, an edict from a premier or an edict from a governor or an edict from a public health officer could put you out of business? We've not only killed the businesses, but we've killed the ecosystem in which business can run. And the only reason why you would do that is if it was a hostile party willfully conscripting public officials to kill themselves. This is analogous to self-destruction because someone has given them the deal that says, you take the fall for melting down your economy and we'll take care of you. These are individuals who have put their individual self-interest above the public.
I still can't fathom them. I can't fathom that notion.
Well, you know, it was funny. I was asked to comment on the land vehicle procurement for the Australian government. And I had the great fortune of being invited to the Victoria Barracks. It's a lovely old kind of draconian looking building. And I pointed out that the Australian federal government had decided to purchase land vehicles that were supposed to be armored. Now, you and I both know what that means. It's supposed to have big pieces of plate steel and all kinds of other things to make sure that the men and women who one day will serve Australia were protected from ordnances that would blow up whether those be IEDs or rocket propelled grenades or whatever got shot at them, right? The whole idea of an armored vehicle, Pete, I think we could agree, was the armor part of the armored vehicle, right? You know, we don't want, let's use your terminology, we don't want a ute with a tarp. We want plate steel. Now, here's the problem. The specification that Australia wrote was a specification that included plate steel that had been already documented to have been compromised in the Ukraine. The Russians figured out how to get a shoulder-fired rocket-propelled grenade to go through the steel that Australia was procuring for the land vehicles. Now, just think about what I just said. This is a new requirement promulgated by the Australian government in 2016. The evidence already existed that said that that particular armor had been compromised. Those are the facts. And Australia went ahead with the acquisition. I sat down with a brigadier general in the Victoria Barracks, and I explained to him the information that I could share with him from both internal and external sources. I have a lot of sources of information, so I shared with him that he had, in fact, made a procurement decision that was going to cost the lives of Australian service members. Because you know what's going to happen. If you're 22 years old, you're the driver of an armored vehicle, you're going to make a decision that says, I can drive into this theater of action because I know I'm in an armored vehicle, right? Because your brain is telling you, Australia would have bought armor for me because I'm in an armored vehicle. That's kind of logical, right? And then all of a sudden, a rocket-propelled grenade goes through and kills all four people inside that vehicle. And I said to the Brigadier General, I said, do you realize that your decision today in 2016 is going to result in a flag-draped coffin for servicemen and women of Australia? I don't know, in 2025 or 2026, when somebody is going to be driving into a theater, they think they're protected, and an RPG is going to go through and take out the entire occupants of that vehicle. And he looked at me and he said the following. He said, David, you don't understand. That's the cost of maintaining the Westminster system. I said, with all due respect, sir, it's not that. It's murder. Murder across an interesting timeline. The decision you've made today is going to result in the avoidable death of Australian servicemen and women. And in your mind, that's justified because you have a deal with the manufacturer of that vehicle company, which conveniently, after you retire from the Australian service, you're going to have a corporate advising engagement with that company. Pete, I know how hard it is because I live this every day. I surface these kinds of informations. I have these kinds of conversations. I know how hard it is to wrap your head around the fact that people who are supposed to be taking an oath to serve and protect and uphold constitutions are actually directly and personally harming the citizens that they have been sworn to protect. But the story I just told you was actually recounted to me in a session about 6 months later at a very large consulting firm, where people talked about the untimely retirement of a particular brigadier general. And they said, somewhere along the line, somebody got information that maybe he had information on some sort of inside corporate transaction. And allegedly, he was briefed at the Victoria Barracks, but nobody knows about it because it was a classified briefing. And I was sitting in the room when this conversation was happening. And I got a big smile on my face. And one of the consulting firm executives looked over at me. He goes, why are you smiling? He goes, were you in that briefing? I said, well, it wasn't classified. Because he didn't close the door of the briefing room because he was too arrogant to realize that to make it a classified briefing, he needed to actually close the door. This is a real story. This really happened. And it really happened in Victoria. Now, my problem is a simple one. For whatever reason, we've decided not to believe that people who are in power should be held accountable. And I don't know when we stopped doing that. But it's really high time that we, the people of the world, start standing up for the fact that when we see deals where, you know, brigadier generals become CEOs of defense companies, right? We need to think about what that meant. And we need to go back and look and go, well, what decisions did they make? What was the quid pro quo that we didn't get to see? And how many times do we see that over and over and over again? There's no question that if we watch very closely who is paying for the current administrations around the world, it is no shock that in the United States and around the world, the pharmaceutical industry right now is paying twice what the oil and natural gas industry is paying to influence politicians. Who's for sale? Well, the fact of the matter is our future has been sold for the birthright for that 1% or 0.5% or 0.25% of the public servants who have decided to sell our future.
My family and I have been using beautiful, high-quality essential oils for the last 20 years to live healthily every single day. Now, if you're passionate about health and are ready to step into leadership, I want to invite you to partner with my team and I to build a beautifully successful doTERRA business. Register at petehlc.com/Pete. That's Pete, HLC, which stands for the Healthy Living Collective, .com/Pete.
I'm crying, brother. I actually am. Like,
Pete, but let's remember something. You and I are having the most important conversation we can have. Because you're right. What I'm talking about is endemic not to Australia and the US. It's endemic to the world right now. We have been had because we've decided that we'll go about our day, we'll go about our life, we'll go about kind of, I have to tell you this, I mean, I have to by law, because of my beautiful wife, I have to by law say I'm a Parramatta fan, right? We've got to be more caught up with who is kind of at the top of the bracket in the NRL. We need to know more about that than we need to know about what's happening with the defense of our country, with the health of our citizens, with the future of our economy. And there is a wake-up call that each one of us must have to say that while we were watching, all of this took place on our watch. Your sadness and your tears are not just your own. They are the sadness and tears of every awakened human being who realizes that in a varying degree, all of us have let ourselves down because we didn't know we had to keep watch. And if there's one message that comes out of the last 20 years of my corporate experience with coronavirus, is I was keeping watch. I started watching coronavirus patents in 1999, 21 years ago. The reason why I can sit here today and recite who got paid what, how many tens of millions of dollars were paid to whose university or whose lab or whose corporate partnership or whose whatever, the reason I can recite those, Pete, is I've been watching it for 21 years.
Okay, I'm trying to come to terms with this, and I understand what you're talking about. And again, this feels like there's so many storylines. Like our prime minister's done a deal with AstraZeneca, I think it's called, one of the vaccine manufacturers.
AstraZeneca. Yes.
And I did a quick little search, and it's already paid out $1 billion in fines and whatever. And then it came out yesterday that somebody's severely compromise from that. And part of me is like, is this a script that's playing out as well?
Yes. They paid AstraZeneca for the Oxford drug, which is one of the competing, there are about five competing kind of global vaccine initiatives, but the Oxford candidate, which is what AstraZeneca has in clinical trials, has not only had one or two adverse events. Pete, listen to their actual numbers. 60% of their participants have had adverse effects, 60%. The virus, when it infects people, only creates an effect in less than 5% of the infected people. right? We have a vaccine that in 60% of the people exposed to the vaccine, they get sick, with a virus that only 5% get sick from. Now, if that's not a script, right? If Scott Morrison can honestly look in the mirror, I mean, Scott Morrison, this is a guy who has been famously religious, famously moral and ethical, famously all kinds of things. But that Scott Morrison has cut a deal with AstraZeneca and Oxford for a drug that is at least 120 times more dangerous than the virus that it's allegedly made to treat. And to your point, the Australian taxpayer has already lost the money, right? And by the way, people need to understand this. When AstraZeneca gets a $1 billion contract and gets a press release that says Australia is buying enough vaccine for its entire population, there's a thing called a price to earnings ratio that goes into the stock market. The $1 billion announcement is parlayed into tens of billions of dollars of market value. Look at how many people inside of the party have holdings in AstraZeneca. Look how many of the mandatory, remember, Australia sold its future a long time ago when it established the Superfund initiative, the superannuation. Look how many superannuation holdings include AstraZeneca. And then go back and tell me, did he really buy $1 billion worth of vaccine, with which, by the way, had no clinical trials, had no evidence of working? By the time he did the acquisition, they already knew that there were neurologic damages from the use of the vaccine. So all of that was known, but he still goes ahead and says, I'm going to vaccinate the entire population of Australia with a thing that has a 60% side effect rate. And who would benefit? Well, it turns out that Oz Super benefits, Superfund managers benefit, because they're holding the equities in these pharmaceutical companies, and they get it 5 to 10 to 30 times return on the $1 billion announcement that he made. So who's winning? And by the way, don't think that the Australian investor is winning, because the Superfunds, as I wrote in a very extensive review of Superfunds while I was still in Melbourne, Superfunds have a dubious distinction of not disclosing all of the returns that they actually should be disclosing to the people who are allegedly the beneficiaries of Superfunds. Now, the great news is there was a Royal Commission investigation. There were a bunch of people who got their hands slapped. But the truth of it was that all of them got away robbing the Australian public. And I mean robbing. I mean, seriously, like back the Brinks truck up and, you know, take the money away. And Superfund managers, without question, watch what politicians say they're going to buy, watch what politicians say they're going to consume, and lo and behold, investments follow, and investments are favored by where those decisions are made. And that's as old as mining, that's as old as energy, that's as old as any of the industries that Australia has participated in.
So how does it work? I mean, again, I'm wrapping my head around it. How do these tech companies, Google, Facebook, Twitter, and China, and Bill Gates, how are they? Are they linked?
Oh, no question. Yeah. So back in 1910 and 1911 in the United States, there was this thing called the Pujo Commission, P-U-J-O. What they looked at was what was called the interlocking directorates. What that meant was that the same people, the Carnegies and the Rockefellers and the Mellons and all these guys, were on each other's boards. So you thought you were dealing with an oil or gas or coal company, and you're really dealing with a steel company, and you're really dealing with a bank, and you're really dealing with all of these interlocking directorates. And it turned out that about 70 people controlled everything. 70 controlled the country. And you didn't have to go very far to see that most of them also had international holdings in Europe. And so before long, you realize that the same 70 people kind of seem to have their finger in every puzzle and every pie. Well, that number has shrunk. It's not 70 anymore. One of the things that people don't understand is initiatives like the 401k program and ERISA and pension programs in the US, things like superannuation in Australia, consolidated large blocks of capital. So now, a very small number of companies are the controlling shareholders of everything. And by everything, I literally mean everything. You know, BlackRock and State Street and these companies that actually hold the equities that are the equity holdings of all of the pensions and all of the savings programs and all of the bank capital and all these other things, they actually are the largest shareholder by record of all assets everywhere. And you have five families in China that have the majority of the assets there. And you have 12 families internationally that have the largest interest in these things, and individuals. So you probably have somewhere between 30 and 40 people total that actually control the economy of the world.
Did they work together?
No question. And they're working very well together, by the way. They're getting enriched by this entire scandal. This is phenomenal, because what's happening is, and you saw this happen in Australia, we've seen it happen in the US. Billions of dollars are being pledged to corporations that have nothing to deliver. I don't know if you remember, but Ford Motor Company got a multi-hundred million dollar contract to make ventilators. Ford Motor Company, you know, the healthcare company. Oh, no, that's right. The car company. Because obviously, if you were going to be getting somebody to make ventilators, the first person you'd turn to is an automobile manufacturer. But if you look at the corporations on which Ford executives and Ford board members sit, you find out why that happened. We've done the interlocking directorate map. We've shown the companies of influence, and companies like Johnson & Johnson, Ford Motor Company, Accenture, have this uncanny ability to show up in entertainment, media, healthcare, automotive, energy, mining, you name it. And you sit there going, well, hold on a minute. How are you on each other's boards? How are you all in this kind of interesting little network? And the fact is, the public just doesn't have visibility, because though each one of those things is disclosed in securities filings and in ASIC requires these disclosures, the SEC requires these disclosures, the London Stock Exchange requires these disclosures, Pete, most people aren't reading the fine print. They're not actually reading the phone book of who runs the world.
So what you're saying is that there's an agenda to cripple the economy? Is that what I'm reading?
There is an agenda to reallocate who is in control. And the answer is that if you actually did the controlled demolition as an economic act, right? If tomorrow we just crashed the market, then it would sound like it was a market event. If we declared a war, then it would be a military event. That's what happened in the Second World War. But if we make a pandemic, this is freaking brilliant, by the way. If we make a pandemic where everybody knows they had to wear a mask, everybody knows they had to social distance, everybody knows they had to work from home, everybody knows they had to be on Zoom as the new way of communicating with the world, everybody knows those things, then in your brain, when you're told, oh, you know what, your pension isn't going to pay out, or your superannuation fund is going to have a 30% hit, or whatever it is, you're going to be told, remember 2020. Remember the pandemic. Listen, this never was about a pandemic. This was always about the controlled demolition of an economy. This was the titans clashing. This is old Greek mythology. These are the stories that we are told in these mythical, gargantuan perspectives where the things that are bigger than us are actually fighting, and we're kind of the, using the African parable, you know, we're the ants and there's elephants fighting, right? It's a bad day to be an ant because elephants have big feet and they can stomp, right? The problem is that if we actually admitted to the problem, and the problem is that we have governments and we have financial institutions who are functionally illiquid, we have private enterprise that has actually been propping up those government contracts and the treasury functions and all kinds of other things for a long period of time. We have trade deals that are not transparent. If we had to let those things become scrutinized on their own merits, then the public would rightfully be very angry at politicians. And I don't know how many politicians that you know in Australia, but I can guarantee you, I don't know many in Australia or in the US that thrive on transparency. Not many of them are willing to get up in front of people and go, you know what, we screwed up. But if you can blame it on a virus, you get to make the same effect and nobody's watching.
So what's the end goal here? You mentioned the titans are fighting. Who are those titans? Is there, you know, without being, I keep hearing Trump is standing up against that. Is he part of the problem? Is he actually, his administration trying to put a finger in the dam, in the dike, so to speak? Or,
well, I think it actually remains to be seen. But let's face the awkward reality, which is the nation state, the idea that we can take this beautiful earth that we find ourselves on and then draw lines around little pieces of land and say, that's Pakistan, that's India, that's Australia, that's New Zealand, that's this, that's that. The fact of the matter is those lines got erased. Certainly by the 1970s, those lines got erased, because far more important than the flag flying over your head is the brand sitting in your kitchen. By 1980, we knew that corporations had in fact purchased governments. Kennedy talked about, and Johnson and others talked about, the military-industrial complex. But that's one metaphor. But there's the media and telecommunications complex. There is the industrial, chemical, pharmaceutical complex. There's a bunch of complexes. But these businesses bought the public sector. The fact that to be elected now, you have to spend all of your time fundraising, not meeting people, not having conversations, not saying, hey, how do I in fact serve you, my constituent? People aren't doing that. They're raising money. And every dollar that they raise comes with a condition. When we look at the amount of funds going into lobbying efforts, going into secured procurements, going into national defense and national healthcare priorities, you can see who owns the world. And by the way, those are laundered through all sorts of different organizations, so it's really tough to track. You know, the number of consulting firms in Australia that are involved in government procurements blows your mind. You know, you're not just buying from somebody, you're buying a report from a consulting firm. The consulting firm tells you who the finalists are going to be. But if you actually look, you find out that the consulting firm is also working for the companies that are the finalists in the consulting report. So who got an objective piece of information? Right? When Anthony Fauci was told Moderna and AstraZeneca were front runners for vaccines, does anybody think it's ironic that those were the two companies that National Institute for Allergy and Infectious Disease, his organization, has the biggest stake in their wins? That's no different from hiring a consulting firm to tell you that their client is the thing that should sell you as the government the thing. This is the problem. The problem is our countries have been sold. And it's very hard for us to wrap our heads around it, but the facts are nothing but self-evident. There is no commitment at the head of state level in most countries. There is no commitment to the citizens of the country. There is a commitment to the illusion of the management of power for one reason and one reason alone. Your signature is going to go on the bottom of the check, which is the return on investment for the person who bought you.
I've heard Australia is a corporation. True or false?
Yep. And an interesting one at that.
Tell me what that means to anybody that's never heard that terminology or understand what that means.
Well, there are a whole host of Commonwealth conditions under which every Commonwealth state acts. And it turns out that throughout the period of time, going from roughly the turn of the last century, the 1900s, to the Second World War, an enormous number of the Commonwealth organizations were corporatized as part of a means by which the Commonwealth could transact with other countries. Probably inside of Australia, one of the things that people would find most alarming is that even within Australia, there are interesting corporate distinctions. So for example, when I was doing a lot of work in Papua New Guinea, I've done tons of work in Papua New Guinea for the last near decade and a half. I was blown away by the fact that Queensland and Queensland mining laws were the things that were written into the sovereign constitution of Papua New Guinea. The Mining Act of Papua New Guinea is actually not an Australian Mining Act, it's a Queensland Mining Act. And it turns out that inside of the corporations are other mini corporations. And these are ways in which this idea that somehow or another there's this quasi-independent status, but the illusion of independence is actually not independent at all. It's actually based on a series of transactions which say that preferred trade relations, preferred other relations, defense, common trade, common currency, common banking, common securities, all of these relationships are flowing through corporate structures. And with those corporate structures come associations and agreements that actually control the resources and the dispensation of wealth that happens within those borders. So what you have is a very complex system, which is actually something that I was amazed to uncover when I saw that it was actually not only explicit, but then written into the constitution of other countries. To think that, for example, Bougainville Copper Limited, one of the most interesting cases of Australian colonialism, where essentially they appealed to the United Nations for the inconvenience of administering Papua New Guinea during the Second World War. They needed to have the world's largest measured copper reserve as a way to pay back all of the inconvenience of Australia's administration of a country during the war. And you sit there kind of going, what? Like, the inconvenience. I mean, yes, I understand there were loss of lives in the Kokoda Trail, and I understand there, you know, Australia did suffer a bit, but really suffered worth a $60 billion asset? That's how much Australia was entitled to for its administration of Papua New Guinea? It was entitled to 6 to 7 times the total measured gross domestic product of the next 100 years of Papua New Guinea. Australia was entitled to that? Well, yes, it was, as a matter of fact, according to the United Nations. And in 1967, the UN said, take Bougainville copper as compensation for the inconvenience of administering Papua New Guinea after the Second World War. You sit there and go, well, hold on a minute. Where was anybody? Like, who was in the room when you made such a ludicrous statement and then made the decision that an entire country, when it wrote its constitution in 1967, 1968, an entire country would actually give to Australia its largest asset and then write it into the constitution such that Bougainville Copper Limited was excluded from any law under the constitution. Bougainville Copper, the Australian company, was actually tantamount to a Vatican City, where it had its own jurisdiction and laws of the country didn't apply because they were written out of the country's laws at the writing of the constitution, who was conveniently done by, are you ready for this? Australia. Pete, the great thing about where we're going right now and the great thing about the time we're living in right now is I say in my film, American Revolution, the best thing about promises being broken is that the promises were a terrible set of promises in the first place. Somewhere along the line, we, the people, were asked to give up our power and give up our accountability and give up our sovereignty in the interest of kind of this benevolent government that was going to return to us defense and security and all this kind of nonsense. That was a siren song of seduction. And the best thing about living today, the best thing about being alive like you and I are right now, is that we get to be the ones that write the next chapter because these promises are broken. The deal was a bad deal. Humanity wasn't factored into this deal. For 200 years, we built an economy based on the fear of death. And for the very first time in 200 years, Pete Evans and Dave Martin and Mickey Willis and other people get to be the architects that we'll talk about 200 or 300 years from now, the ones that woke up and said, hey, how about we make the next 200 years economies and societies and civilization It is actually built on the quality of life, not the fear of death. We came here for this reason, right? You're alive for this reason. I'm alive for this reason. We're in this conversation because it will be, once again, people of integrity, people of character, people of great courage who are going to stand together and say, the deal of the last 200 years, the world built on warfare and colonialization and the raping and pillaging literally and figuratively of the earth and society and cultures, that deal was a bad deal. The gospel, according to Adam Smith, was a bad deal. And we get to write the next chapter. So I'm so excited that I'm talking to an Australian who has spent the last, I don't know how many years, but man, you've been trying to wake people up to their health and their life and their livelihood and their vitality and their body and caring about what they put in themselves. And you're the perfect person for me to be talking to, because you of all people, you of all Australians know that we have to wake up to our living so that we can start building systems that are predicated on life and on liberty and on vitality, because that is our future.
How?
Well, we just started, didn't we? We just started. You and I separated allegedly by 13,000 nautical miles have just formed this beautiful polar magnet to which things will attract. The things that will attract will be people who go, you know what? I'd rather live in a transparent and accountable and responsible way. I would rather know that I am the person to whom I should count on for the things that are the fabric of my life, not rely on Scott Morrison or Dan Andrews or fill in the blank. No, rely on the quality and the character of who you are. Rely on the friends that are not Facebook likes, not thumbs up, but the friends that will go out to eat with you, the friends that will watch your kids, the friends that will be there when you're not feeling well, the friends that have that word of encouragement when you're feeling down, those friends, not Facebook friends, not social media friends, real friends. And what you're going to see is, as we have connected, remember, how did this happen, right? This happened because Mickey Willis had this guy, Matt Belair, and Matt Belair said to Mickey, hey, there's this guy that wears a bow tie that you should be talking to. And then that happened. And then I got into the film, and Eric Felderhoff, who's an amazing guy and is just Mickey's right-hand man, helps him out with all kinds of things, produces amazing content. Eric goes, you really got to talk to Pete. So boom, here we are. We are assembling right now, right? We're assembling the critical mass of those who will be the architects of the documents that one day will be remembered. Like in 1217, when King Henry III, standing on the steps of St. Paul's Cathedral in London, read for the very first time the Magna Carta and the Charter of the Forest, which was signed by less than 60 people. We are the Thomas Jeffersons and the James Madisons and the Ben Franklins having the conversation about what is it like to build a country on life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, right? We're that group. So the how starts with recognizing that we are the lucky ones. We're the ones that 230 years later get to sit together and go, hey, hold on a second. What does Pete Evans have? Well, man, he has a sense of what it means to nourish humanity in a constructive way, what it means to feed the body and the soul. So Pete's got a role to play. What does Dave have? Well, Dave has all this crazy data and intelligence and perspective and history. So he's got his piece to play. And like any good recipe, I have to say that. I mean, I'm talking to a chef. Like any great recipe, you can walk into a kitchen and you can see the cake, or you can see the roast, or you can see the thing that somebody who doesn't know how to cook can't see. And what we're doing right now is we're filling the pantry, right? We're filling the pantry with the ingredients that is going to become that beautiful meal, which is going to be the nourishment of the future of humanity. So our job right now is to do exactly what we're doing. Be passionate, be excited, be enthusiastic, let our emotions actually flow, connect with the humanity that we all have, and realize that no one can take this from us. This is ours. This is our sovereign right, our sovereign grant. This was the inalienable aspect of humanity that was woven into the fabric of our chromosomes long, long, long before we had our first thought. We came for this moment. And who knew that I would be having a conversation with a master chef who, when I said Pete Evans, would light up the face of the most beautiful Australian who happens to be living in the same house I'm in here in Charlottesville, Virginia, going, "You mean that Pete Evans?" And I'm like, "Yes, that Pete Evans." What a great moment. What a great moment to share this time in the human story, to say that we were all prepared exactly, correctly, precisely for this moment.
I love you, brother. And for each and every person that's listening, their steps, their take me through this.
Yeah. So, you know, one of the things that I find so amazingly important at this time is to recognize that this is a moment, this is a season. I happen to look at a world from a lens that may be a slight unusual lens. But I think that sometimes it takes a pretty big alarm clock to wake us up from our sleep. I'd like us to think of COVID as an alarm clock. It's annoying, right? And if it happens on a weekend, you kind of go, how do I get it to shut up? But it's an alarm clock. That's what it is. It's an opportunity for us to realize that there were parts of us that were sleeping. We weren't doing a very good job, probably for the last, 10 years. We probably weren't doing a very good job of prioritizing what it meant to be friends. We probably were more interested in how many likes we had on our picture on Instagram or Facebook than we were about, hey, do I need to take, a lasagna across the street to a neighbor who's struggling with a kid that's not well? Or do I need to sit down and be the listening post for a friend that's struggling? We probably got our priorities a little screwed up. Through the cunning use of technology, we pretended to be connected, but we got further and further apart. And the first thing I always tell people is a line that I used in my film, American Revolution. I actually talk about the fact that I want you to reach out and touch someone. I mean, literally right now, as you're listening, or as soon as you can, touch another human being. And have gratitude for the fact that they are not a virtual reality hologram constructed by a corporation delivered for an ephemeral experience of some sort of constructed illusion. They have blood running through their arteries and their veins. They have flesh. They have breath. They have a pulse. They have a soul. And have gratitude for the fact that not only you are able to touch them, but with any luck, they'll touch you back. Right? Have the ability to enjoy the analog. When you actually put a piece of food in your mouth after you've listened to this, ask yourself, do I really know where this came from? And if I don't, whatever it is, put the fork down, put the spoon down, and think about having gratitude for the farmer who grew the kale, or have gratitude for the harvester of the whatever it is that you just ate, or have gratitude for the life that is the life that you're participating with as you consume it. Like, whatever that is, start slowing down to the human speed and realize that the very first thing we have to do is we have to reconnect with our own souls, because we have to have a sense of our own identity. We have to have a sense of our own purpose. We have to have a sense of the sacred before we can actually ever engage in the rest of what we're called to do. If we have not accessed our humanity at our own internal level, we can't aspire to seeing it in others. So the first thing to do is actually be human. The second thing to do is actually to remember that we were instructed and coerced into a catechism of consumption. Our identities were built around how much money we could hoard, how big our houses were, whatever else. The very famous kind of New Deal, Roosevelt era, a car in every garage, a chicken in every pot. Well, there's nothing intrinsically wrong with that, but if your identity is that, there's something terribly wrong. So recognize that we were enculturated and indoctrinated and trained into this notion that we had to give up our lives in service to pursuing things so that one day we'd have enough things to kind of eke out the last 5 to 10 years, retiring in this palace of collected things that came at the expense of our whole life. Well, that's a crap deal. So let's not do the deal anymore. Let's actually start saying, well, you know what? If a child needs care or needs a parent's attention, that's probably more important than making sure that we have the $10,000 for the cruise that we might not take a year from now. It's probably better if we actually spend time working on ourselves in the moment and making sure that the present is actually fully experienced and fully realized. And those are a couple of easy first steps. But then we realize that the next step becomes where we start engaging with the rest of the system. Because the next step becomes when we realize that how we get our information needs to go back to conversations and thoughtful dialogue, not memes, not likes, not Twitter feeds, not headlines. But I've made mention on this conversation to 1217, the Charter of the Forest at St. Paul's Cathedral. I made reference to the Bretton Woods Accords. I made reference to 1971 when the gold standard was lifted. I made reference to all these things. These are not Googleable, searchable things. These are things that are written about in books. These are things that you can talk to people about. You can learn about from a variety of inputs. We need to open up the aperture of insight because we can only be brainwashed and duped if we only get our information through the controlled, contrived, curated narrative of Google and Facebook and YouTube and Twitter and Instagram. We need to open up that aperture again. And that means put down the cell phone and pick up a conversation with a grandmother. Pick up a conversation with an elder. Think about the number of elders who have wisdom in Australia who have been long silenced, right? Pick up those conversations. Learn what it is to even understand what is a song line? What is a dream state? What are all of these things? How do we open our minds to the wisdom that's around us? Take walks in nature. Begin to get regrounded. And then what happens is a fire gets kindled within you. And that fire then allows you in your community to start taking an active interest in the homeless, or to start taking active interest in after-school care, or take an active interest in things that used to be given to the government as things that they're going to do for us. Well, stop. Do it. Because what happens is as we enter our humanity, we will realize that we can do a better job cooking for kids than any mass-produced Woolies or, you know, Kohl's could ever have done by putting together crap cheese and crap biscuits and crap whatever else in an after-school snack bag, right? We the people do a better job of caring for we the people than corporate, government-sponsored fill-in-the-blank. Pete, what's the beautiful thing about the fabric of the new humanity is that it's built on doing things that we all can do. The number of people who think they've accomplished something by marching in streets blows my mind. Make soup and give it to the homeless, right? Go through your cupboard and say that you probably have 50% of your cupboard that you didn't wear last season. So I got a crazy ass idea. Why don't you take 50% of your cupboard and make sure people who aren't able to be clothed appropriately have clothing? Like, these are basic things, but we have to get back to that basic humanity. And what will happen is that the government will start realizing that people aren't showing up for their handouts anymore. People can't be bought anymore. And all of a sudden, we create by being human an existential crisis to a system that counted on our inhumanity. If we don't like the outcome we're currently living in, we have to start cutting the foundation stones of a system that won't allow this to happen again. You cannot have your life and your liberty taken by a person who has no control over you. And my dining room table doesn't have masks. He doesn't have social distancing. And throughout this entire campaign of terror, I have fed hundreds of people around my table. And in so doing, I have actually opened up the conversations that led to the Matt Belairs, that led to the Mickey Willises, that led to the Eric Felderhoffs, that led to you. The story is simple. Be human. And your humanity cannot be taken from you.
David, I love you, brother. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. This has been perfect.
It is perfect. And this conversation was perfect. Every bit about the way in which you hold open such a beautiful space and such a beautiful heart is perfect. And I am in the debt of honor for having this opportunity to speak to you, Pete. Thank you very much.
I look forward to sharing a meal with you in person and your wonderful family. So thank you.
Hey, you know, I'm not sure I can match you on paleo, but I can pull some pretty cool things out of the pantry. So you're on.
And I guess I should say, watch this space. What next for you, David? I mean, you have in the past taken on some of these big corporations.
And yeah.
Obviously, you have the brains, as we started this, and the tenacity and the determination, and you see things through a different lens than most. So
yeah.
are you dismantling, or what's your intention now with all of this, now that it's out in the open and it's becoming more and more visible?
Yeah, I'll give you a little picture for this. You know, in Star Wars, the Death Star is always funny because outside the Death Star, you got all these zipping things like spacecrafts and they're shooting lasers and they're having all this kind of cool stuff. And then as you get close to the Death Star, you know, the outside of the Death Star has got all these, you know, gun turrets and all kinds of other crazy stuff. And kind of in the first two layers of the Death Star, you never actually see the elevator, but you think of it as kind of the first two layers of the Death Star. You got the stormtroopers and you got all the crazy stuff going on. But have you ever realized that inside the nuclear reactor, like the core of the Death Star, is this big cavernous space and nobody's defending it? Nobody. Right? You've never seen a Star Wars movie where the inside of the Death Star has anybody in it. It turns out that's real, Pete. You know, the funny thing is that the current incumbent systems, this Adam Smith corporate, turn everybody into the laborer, turn everybody into the barely getting along, barely pulling it off, like barely everything, right? We're holding on. It turns out that, well, that's built on a Death Star too. And I found my way to the reactor core. I actually got there in 2015. That's the coolest part about this. Because in 2015, I actually created a system which became, as your listeners can go back and look, became the CNBC IQ 100 index. It was the top performing, top equity index in the world. It was the best. And the funny thing is that when you become the scorecard of the economy, you're the scorekeeper of the economy, these corporations have an interesting problem because they may not like what I do, but they have all this external trappings, all the ego, all of the energy that's on their outside, and they don't want to be taken off that list. Because their ego wants to be one of the most innovative companies in the world. They want to be on my index. You know, the funny thing is, I hold, with the simple stroke of a key, more of their fate than they would like. The reactor core of what is propping up this current system is ego, is power, but its reactor core is empty. This whole thing has been an illusion for a long time. And the stormtroopers know it, right? The forces of the dark side know it. They all know it. They know that the reactor core is empty. And a cool thing is, if you can introduce a little wobble in the middle of the Death Star falls apart. Part of what's happening, and every step we're taking right now, is to reclaim something that was lost in the 13th century. It's time for us to be accountable for how we treat this earth again. It's time to be accountable for how we treat each other again. It's time to be accountable for how our organizations and corporations work. And my long game is really simple. If I actually live to see the full kind of fruition of my long game, corporations won't be limited liability anymore. They'll be accountable for everything. Nation states won't have sovereign immunity. If you're elected, you'll be responsible for what you do. And what I'm saying right now is as heretical as any part of any reformation has ever been. Because the idea that you do not by title have the opportunity to ever step aside from your responsibility as a human is a world that we all want to live in. We do want to live in that world. And the great news is we will. And I don't care whether I'm around to see it, because I know that I'm already introducing the wobble in the middle of the Death Star, and I can hear the thing creak, and I can hear the bits fall apart, and I can hear the stormtroopers running, and I know what's next. So the cool thing is, this is something, and the best part about it is, I told you, I got there in 2015, so I'm 5 years into the win already. We are building the thing which will be what comes next. And it will be based on a foundation that's not going to be one person, and it's not going to be one ego, and it's not going to be one flag, and it's not going to be one anything. It's going to be we the people standing together, locking shoulder to shoulder, making sure that we are a phalanx that cannot be broken. So that's what's next. Humans win. That's next.
Oh, beautiful, brother. Well, count me in. Whatever I can do to help everybody that's listening is in too, no doubt.
Pete, thanks so much. It's great to know you.
You too, brother. Thank you. I look forward to that roast.
You got it.
See you, man.
If you would like to become a qualified health coach, then the Institute for Integrative Nutrition, or IIN for short, can help you achieve your goals. I completed the health coaching course many years ago, which has been one of the catalysts for my own journey into what I now love to do, which is to help people achieve greater health through the sharing of information through my books, seminars, podcasts, TV shows, and films. I recommend IIN for anyone wishing to pursue a career in the health coaching and wellness space. IIN is a one-year course, so that if you're a full-time worker, busy parent, or wherever you are in your life, it is flexible enough so you'll be able to complete all the required curriculum. Please see the link included in the podcast show notes or my website to access the free sample class and first module of their program. This will give you a great taste of the format as well as the structure, and you can also utilize my special discount that I can offer you if you decide to sign up. Make sure you tell the admissions team that you're part of the Pete Evans Tuition Savings to claim your very substantial discount. Please visit integrativenutrition.com or email admissions@integrativenutrition.com.
The information, views, and opinions expressed in this podcast should not be treated as a substitute for nutritional, medical, or other advice by a qualified professional. Guests in this podcast express their own opinions, experiences, and conclusions. Nothing in this podcast should be used to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any medical condition. Neither Pete Evans nor any sponsor endorse any views, opinions, or conclusions expressed or shared in this podcast.